Utena Tenjo wondered idly what was going on. There was a weird tension in the air on campus this morning. She could feel it, and she could tell from the look on Caitlin's face that her roommate felt it too. All four of them in the little group that left the Wedge at 8:45, bound for Olin Hall and the first of the term's final exams, felt it. Devlin Carter was uncharacteristically quiet, looking thoughtfully around, and Amanda Dessler's nerves seemed on edge as well. She kept fidgeting with the grip of her gladius-like gamelan dress sword, her good eye darting around as if she expected something to happen. Halfway across the quad, something did. Four people, three men and a woman, dressed in trim black uniforms with gleaming gold badges, came marching across from Harrington Auditorium, their gait purposeful, all intent on the four students. Utena's funny feeling escalated to a full-on alert. What in the world were four psychops doing on campus? Devlin Edison Carter, the man in the lead, said in an imperious voice as the four psychops came within hailing range, "You are under arrest." "What?" said Utena, causing the lead psychop to turn his disinterested brown eyes to her. "This is none of your concern, Miss Tenjo. Continue on to your examination, all of you." Devlin took a half step back, every muscle in his body tense. "Don't be stupid, Blip," said the female psychop. "You're caught. It's all over." Caitlin and Utena glanced at each other in shock. Devlin? Devlin Carter? A rogue telepath? Kate's eyes held a question. Utena's eyes held the answer. Neither of them had to speak. Devlin backed up another step, but the four black-clad officers moved in, surrounding him, apparently ignoring his companions. One of the men, a short, dark-haired, rather stocky fellow, took Devlin by the arm. "Take your hand off him," Amanda snarled. The psychop turned to her. "Stay out of this," he said snidely. "We told you it's none of your concern." "Devlin is our friend," said Utena obstinately. "That makes it our concern." "Well, Miss Tenjo," said the woman cop coolly, "your friend is a dangerous criminal, and this is a lawful arrest under the Psionics Regulation and Protection Act. If you continue interfering, you will be subject to arrest as well." She looked Utena up and down once, smiling superciliously, and added, "The penalties for aiding and abetting a fugitive from the Psi Corps are quite severe." "You don't scare me," Utena replied flatly. "You and your Psi act. Show me your evidence."
"You couldn't comprehend our evidence," sneered the dark-haired one.
"And we are hardly required to justify ourselves to children," the woman put in, still with that same cool, superior tone. "Back off, little girl, before you get in too deep." Utena stared hard at the psychop for a few seconds. Then her shoulders slumped, and she half turned away. Amanda's face went blank with shock, then darkened in disgust. Devlin sagged a little bit, his face stricken. Only Caitlin understood. The female cop dismissed her defeated adversary from her thoughts and turned to deal with the arrest. Even a telepath can be caught unawares if she's making a point of not paying attention. Utena's elbow rammed into the back of the psychop's skull with an extremely satisfying sound, and the black-clad woman pitched to the grass of the quad without so much as a whimper.
"Run!"
the pink-haired duelist bellowed at Devlin, even as Caitlin swept in to protect her roommate's flank. The duelist leader's still-sheathed Zatoichi hissed around in a great arc, knocking free the startled shorter cop's grip on Devlin's arm.
"What the hell? Control, this is the arrest team. We have a Code 2 emergency and..."
Amanda knocked him down, seized Devlin's arm, and dragged him into a run across the quad. They vanished into the alley between the alumni gym and Harrington Auditorium. What ensued on the quad would subsequently be taught in Psi Corps Enforcement Division training courses as an example of the dangers of underestimating one's opposition. The sudden, totally unexpected, violent resistance from Carter's two friends took the arrest team so completely by surprise that they were unable to marshal their telepathic powers for attack. And one of the truisms of TP combat is that it's very difficult to concentrate on an attack if your opponent keeps hitting you. It took the arrival of an enforcer squad with stun-set phasers to subdue the two duelist officers. Psycop Carmela Sunderland wiped a trickle of blood from the corner of her mouth, felt gingerly at the lump on the back of her head, and restrained herself from aiming a kick at the pink-haired duelist's ribs, now that the girl was helpless on the ground. She was, after all, a professional. "Take them to the temporary holding area," she ordered the enforcers. "I wonder why they didn't use those swords on us," wondered Jerome Rabin, the short, stocky one, nursing the arm Kate had nearly broken. "Who knows," replied Sunderland, "probably afraid of the consequences. Not that they're going to have much fun as it is," she added darkly. "Come on, let's find that blip. He can't get too far. The campus is sealed off." Devlin and Amanda had just reached that conclusion, having nearly run into the arms of a second enforcer squad setting up a roadblock on West Street at the opposite end of campus. Now they crouched with their backs to the rear wall of Olin Hall, sheltered by the small grove of trees that grew back there and the fence of the Higgins House Gardens.
"I always knew this day would come," panted Devlin.
He reached into his pocket and drew out the compact PPG he'd used to defend Amanda's life during their recent, eventful trip to Gamelon.
"What are you planning to do with that?" Amanda inquired. "It won't even scratch an enforcer's armor."
"I didn't buy it to use on the core," Devlin replied.
Amanda gave him an odd look, which melted into horror as she realized what he meant.
"Well," he said with a weak grin, "at the time I didn't have you to live for. What?"
"Earthman, how badly do you want to get out of this?" asked Amanda seriously.
"About as badly as you can imagine," Devlin replied. "If they take me, my life is over. Oh, I'll go on breathing, but I'll never see this place, or my family, or any of you ever again. The Corps is mother, the Corps is father. It'll be for my own good, of course," he added, disdain twisting his features.
Amanda drew her katail and examined its iridescent blade thoughtfully. "I may be able to give you a way out," she said, "but it will hurt, and it may be complicated to reverse later."
"Not as complicated as being taken by the Corps, I'd wager. Do it. Whatever it is, just do it."
The sounds of searching officers were drawing closer. They'd be found very soon. Amanda's good eye searched Devlin's face. Aside from that, she was as motionless as a statue.
"Please," Devlin whispered.
Slowly, Amanda nodded. Then, in one lightning-fast movement, she slashed his face, laying open his left cheek from just under his eye to the corner of his jaw. He reeled back in shock as the pain bloomed scarlet, dropping his PPG and clapping his hand to his wounded face. At that precise moment, a pair of enforcers rounded Olin Hall and shouted for them to stop. "I am a princess of the Gamelon Empire," Amanda informed them imperiously, "and this man is my battle prize."
"Yeah," replied one of the enforcers with a sneer, "and I'm Madame Curie."
And his phaser screamed them both down. As her katail fell with a thud to the grassy ground and she fell after it, Amanda had only time to think, "I'm sorry, my love. I tried." Up in Morgan 412, Tiny Robo put down his gin rummy hand and stood up, his permanently scowling face gazing off into some unknown distance, as if he were listening to a silent call. Opposite him, on the top of Caitlin's bookshelf, Lesser Mazinger laid down his cards as well and got to his feet, closely attending to his slightly larger counterpart's behavior. Miki Kaworu was halfway to Institute Road when the shout of his galaxy housemate Mia Ausa pulled him to a stop. Mia, who didn't have a final today, was standing in the doorway in her Minbari sleeping robe, her long black hair disarrayed, waving what looked like a printout. Miki paused, turned around, and trotted back. "What is it?" he asked, confused and a little concerned by Mia's apparent sense of urgency. "Look at this," said Mia breathlessly, as she pressed the printout into Miki's hand. "Return path, Durandal, at durandal.wpi.k12. Date, Monday, 2nd of May, 2405, 09-11-29, minus 0500 ET. X sender, Durandal at localhost.localdomain. 2, Institute Duelist Society, duelists at wpi.k12. CC, Moose at wpi.k12, Jacron at wpi.k12, H. McKenzie at wpi.k12. Subject, heads up. Durandal 1707, incoming message from Durandal. You should probably know that your president and vice president have been arrested by the Psi Corps for interfering in the arrest of a rogue telepath, one Devlin Carter of your acquaintance. Princess Dessler has also been arrested. I can only assume the officers involved don't know who she is, or more to the point, who her father is. They're now placing the entire campus under a security lockdown and communications blackout. This is standard operating procedure for a blip apprehension that turns into a fight, to prevent any other blips who may be in the area from escaping. I recommend you regroup someplace off campus, may I humbly suggest Galaxy House, then get as far away as possible while there are still gaps in the core security net. They're already bringing your non-duelist friends to interrogate them about your activities. The rest of you probably aren't blips, but you are on the EarthGov watch list as possible subversives and saboteurs, and under the circumstances, the enforcers won't need much of an excuse to round you all up and make you disappear. I'll do what I can for your friends, but I have my own escape to consider, so don't expect miracles. Sic Semper Tyrannis, Durandal. Miki stared at the printout, then looked up and met Mia's troubled eyes. "Well, shit," he said with feeling. Harcourt M. Mac McKenzie walked steadily into what had, hours before, been the office of the Dean of Sciences. The new occupants had quite thoughtfully laid blackout across the windows and cleared away all the Dean's personal effects to prevent distraction. The new spotlights glaring onto the chair in front of the desk were, to Mac's ironic thought, a very nice touch of quality workmanship. "We like to think so," a voice from the back of the office chuckled, and Mac frowned. Already the interrogation had begun, it seemed. "But do not be concerned. As opportune as your presence is, we do not have time for the proverbial third degree today. This will only be a level one probe. Today." The stop before the last word said volumes about how the man stepping to the desk would like to conduct the proceedings, most likely by disassembling Mac's mind just for the enjoyment of taking it apart. His escort closed the door behind Mac, shutting off all sources of light except the spotlights and a small desk lamp in the corner of the room. Mac's escort seated himself there, activated the portable terminal present, and waited as the man in shadow seated himself in the dean's chair. "Let us begin," the latter said quietly. "Name?" "McKenzie," Mac replied. "Harcourt, middle initial M." As the soft plinking of fingertips on touchpads echoed from the corner, the Psi Corps man continued, "Date of birth? December 29th, 2388, Galactic Standard Calendar," Mac said. "Planet or nation of origin?" "Confederate Free Spacers Alliance." "Mark that as a no allegiance claim, Smythe," the Psycop said. "The Confederate Free Spacer Alliance was first recognized as a sovereign and independent nation-state in 2002 by the Empire of Seleucia. Max said in a level, almost monotone voice. It was admitted to the United Galactica in 2003 and was a founding member of the United Federation of Planets in 2338. As of the Federation 2400 census, it held a population of 3,174,000 citizens, making it larger than three other worlds with Federation Council seats and of greater population than 792 planets and habitats claimed by the Federation. The silence drew the darkness closer, giving it a density, even a life of its own. When the Psi-Cor man spoke, his voice did not remove the shadow's weight. I said mark that as no allegiance claimed, Smythe. Fingertips danced across the terminal again. To continue, the Psi-Cor man said with a wry turn to his voice. What is your Psi rating? Unknown. Mac had no intention of lying or even misleading a telepath, and for all its craftsmanship, the red card in his wallet was a forgery. The Psi-Cor man paused a moment before saying, Mark that as unregistered null, Smythe. Why are you not registered? Two reasons, said Mac. First, my government does not recognize the Psi-Cor as having authority over free spacer citizens. For that matter, it does not recognize the Psi Act as constitutional under Federation law. Second, I quite frankly disliked the idea of allowing a telepath with a cop mentality to traipse through my brain doing who knows what. Smythe, leave out the first part, the Psi-Cor man said. Might I ask, Mac inquired, unable to restrain a smirk, what point there is to this interrogation if you record only those answers that suit your needs? The Psi-Cor man leaned over the desk slightly, his face coming into the reflected light from the spots, and smiled a very humorless smile. He was a rather unremarkable-looking man, really, with short, slightly graying blonde hair and not much of a chin, but he had lifeless eyes, a shark's eyes, and they matched his dry, colorless voice perfectly. Your so-called government does not recognize our authority. It should be only fair, to your liberal concept of the term, that we reciprocate an identical amount of respect for their authority. Every single human being in this school, students, faculty, employees, is going to be interviewed and scanned, Mr. McKenzie, the Psi-Cop continued. You were chosen as our first interviewee for two reasons. One, you cohabit a dormitory with several known accomplices of the reported blip. And two, you are the first free spacer pirate we have managed to lay hands on within our jurisdiction. And now we have you. And now we have the authority to actually do something meaningful with you if we desire. If you had so much as twitched your nose a few minutes ago when I scanned you for your deepest secret, you would never see the light of day again. At least, not as Harcourt Mudd McKenzie. Mac rigidly restrained himself from wincing at his hated middle name, but the cop caught his reaction anyway and smiled coldly. As it is, he went on with a soft, petulant sigh, I will probably have to let you go in the end. Your only value to me is information, and there are dozens of students on this campus better acquainted with Devlin Carter than... The Psi-Cop trailed off as he sensed Mac's confusion, and a moment later, shock. Well, the Psi-Cop said at last, that's one bit of information. Nobody told you he was a telepath, did they? I don't get out of my room much, except for classes and cooking, Mac said quietly. Well, the Psi-Cop smiled, when this interview is over... You can tell those friends of yours who probably do know not to bother trying to keep any secrets. And tell your friends in the Freespacer Pirate Fleet that the questioning you received here was only a warning. Any Freespacers we run across in the future will be quite thoroughly debriefed. Mac tried to settle the cold knot in his stomach again, tried to focus past his emotional upheavals like he had before. But the gaze of those two cold eyes, glinting from the shadows with his reflection, held his attention and shattered his self-control. "Now, Mr. McKenzie, you will tell me when and how you first met Devlin Carter. Be sure to leave nothing out, and do try to keep a strong visualization in your mind. It makes the scan less stressful for both of us." Mac paused for a moment, gathering himself, sternly instructing himself not to babble, not to prevaricate, to stick straight to the unadulterated truth. Stick to the absolute truth. And, he carefully did not think, to only the truths asked for. With that kept out of his mind, which he focused in perversity on images of a pink bandersnatch, Mac began to talk.
"Chang, this is Saunders. Check in."
The lean Asian man in the gray Psi-Corps utility uniform, not a Psi-Cop, but a lower-grade telepath assigned to the Enforcement Division, tabbed the golden Psi-Com badge on his uniform and replied,
"Chang here."
"What's going on over there?"
"Nothing," Chang replied.
He was in one of the faculty offices on the second floor of Alden Memorial, which had been commandeered as a detention area. The rear half of the office, usually inhabited by Professor Curran of the music department, had been subdivided with a portable force field generator into a detention cell. Outside that field, Branford Chang sat in Professor Curran's chair with his back to the door.
"Nothing," replied Saunders's voice from his comm badge. "As in the prisoner's quiet?"
"I've never seen anything like it," Chang replied. "She's just sitting there." And indeed, ever since Caitlin Hutchins had been relieved of her personal effects and sealed behind the detention field, she had been doing exactly that. Normally, prisoners either tried to make deals, begged for their freedom, railed ineffectual threats, or at least paced and glared. Prisoner number 4, the one Saunders was guarding in the office across the hall, was definitely one of the pace and glare variety, and if looks could kill, the pink-haired girl's gaze would have cut Jerry Saunders in half. Prisoner number 3, on the other hand, had gathered her dignity after being shoved into the makeshift cell, turned to face the field and her captor, and then, very calmly and deliberately, sank into César in the exact center of the cell. She'd placed her hands on her knees, closed her eyes, and there she remained, 3 hours later, in precisely the same position. Chang was familiar with the posture. He had some martial arts training himself as part of his Enforcement Division combat training. Still, the perfect, utter calm of this prisoner, especially for her age, was just plain unnerving. Chang was a grown man with training in mental discipline, and he could only sit that way for an hour or so before he had to get up and stretch or do something. Even more unnerving, though, was what was going on in prisoner number 3's mind. Your normal prisoner daydreamed of escape, or of what he'd like to do to the guard, or tried desperately to think of ways out. According to Saunders, prisoner number 4's thoughts centered primarily around doing painful-looking things to Carmela Sunderland, a sentiment behind which both Saunders and Chang could get. This prisoner's thoughts, on the other hand, well, she didn't have any. Her mind was a cool and silent place, as still and placid as her body. Nothing moved except the quiet murmur of the unconscious, too deep for Chang's P5 talent to probe without physical contact and considerable effort. Even Director Tremaine, who'd stopped in briefly and scanned her, had come away with nothing. A deep scan hadn't even made her twitch or whimper. Roger had been impressed, and had said so in a conversational sort of tone before promising to come back later and give the prisoner the attention such a worthy opponent deserved. Chang, for his part, was a little bit scared. He'd never seen such mental discipline in a normal. It was rare even among teeps, and in a teenage girl it was downright creepy. If Director Tremaine did come back to give her a real working over, she wouldn't last, but still. Chang decided he'd be just as glad to get relieved of duty before the director came back. He had to admit it, he admired the prisoner's composure. He'd rather not have to stick around and see it shattered by a Psycop's full strength.
"Welcome back to consciousness, Mr. Carter," said a cold voice softly. "Oh, it's no use pretending you're still asleep. I knew it the moment you surfaced. I trust your face isn't paining you too badly."
Devlin's eyes opened slowly, and he took stock of his situation. He was in a chair in what looked like one of the Alden Memorial offices, behind a temporary detention field. On the other side of the field stood a man in a Psycop's uniform, with another seated at the professor's desk, taking notes on a datapad.
"Ah," said the standing cop with a slight smile. "You recognize me."
"Roger Tremaine," said Devlin, his voice calm. "Director of Enforcement Operations, Sector 3.
"Of course," said Roger. "You would know my name, wouldn't you? After all, you were brazenly operating right here in my own region, not as a transient, but as a resident student. Of course you would make it your business to learn the name of the man whose authority you were flouting. It makes it all more satisfying to know whom you're beating on a personal level, doesn't it?"
Devlin looked back at him and said nothing.
"According to the tests we made when you were unconscious, your P rating is 12, said Roger conversationally.
"The same as mine, although I have a great deal more experience in its use.
Still, that's quite remarkable. You may be the highest-rated original blip in history."
Devlin understood his meaning without having to ask for clarification. An original blip was an unregistered telepath, one who had eluded the Corps' screenings in the first place, as opposed to a renegade blip, who had joined the Corps, but at some point thrown off its indoctrination, slipped its bonds, and vanished into the underground.
P-12, Roger mused thoughtfully. "That's much too high for you to have learned to function in society all on your own. No, you must have been trained, and trained by an expert." Roger deactivated the detention field, pulled a chair into the makeshift cell with him, and sat down right in front of Devlin, boring into him with those cold gray eyes.
"At your level, an expert means one of us. A Psycop gone bad, turned against the Corps that gave him shelter and protection."
Devlin narrowed his eyes. "Spare me the public relations bump," he said. Then he looked thoughtful, as if something had just occurred to him.
Roger smiled. "Yes," he said. "You're wondering why you're not on sleepers. Well, if you were, if we'd drowned your talent in drugs, that would make my job considerably harder. My job, you see, is to find out who trained you."
"Good luck," Devlin replied. "I don't remember."
"Well, then," said Roger pleasantly, "let's see if I can remember for you."
Then all trace of humor vanished from his face, and Devlin Carter screamed.
Galaxy House's inhabitants and the rest of the duelists sat crowded into the living room, the silence of the tomb weighing upon them. The afternoon sun failed to illuminate the gray, dour interior which, only days before, had been a bright and cheerful home even in the worst rains, snowstorms, and gloomy Worcester mists. Nobody wanted to speak. There really wasn't much that could be said. The click of the front door latch snapped the silence and jolted the assembled students out of their reverie. Through the door staggered Mac, wrung out and trembling, stumbling and swaying his way over to a couch. Moose and Jacron caught an arm each as Mac tripped over his own feet, and they gently lowered him into an empty armchair. Mickey stepped into the kitchen momentarily, offered Mac a glass of water, and was waved away weakly.
"Behind my bed, in the cabinet," Mac whispered, "and bring all the glasses."
Mickey blinked,
walked into 22S2, and returned about a minute later, carefully toting an unopened bottle of 2393 Jim Beam bourbon and half a dozen shot glasses. "I'm pretty sure we're all underage," he mused. "Allergic myself," Sky said with a scrangish shrug. "I'd have to put away most of that myself to even move a blood alcohol meter," Moose noted. "Either way, I think I'll pass for the moment." When nobody offered to join Mac, he held up two fingers. Miki, making a rough guess at what that meant, filled one shot glass about half full. "No," Mac grumbled. "Two shots. Full." Miki blinked, then did as instructed. He pulled out his stopwatch and started it, as Mac downed the first jigger at once. At first, the free spacer took a deep breath, apparently unaffected. Then his eyes bulged open, his second breath ended in a single weak cough, and for several seconds he looked unable to take a third breath. As soon as he managed that, however, he gestured for the second shot and, with similar results, downed that too. Miki stopped the watch and made notes as Mac recovered from the second shot. Gradually, the muscle twitches and shaking subsided, the sweats faded, and Mac said in a clearer voice, "Dad gave that to me for medicinal purposes," he said. "If that's the medicine, God save me from the disease."
"If it's so awful," asked Moose, "why'd you drink it?"
Mac took several seconds to compose his thoughts, a difficult task with two shots of aged bourbon whiskey percolating through one's bloodstream. "I told no lies," he said at last. "I did not attempt to hide anything. I did not use clever technical wording to hide the truth." He looked longingly at the bottle again for a moment, then added, "But I did not tell them everything, because they did not know the questions to ask yet. They know that I know something more, but they haven't had time to get to the general human population of the school, much less the aliens. They did say in my hearing that they plan to impound Dorothy as soon as the legal boys nullify her Turing application. They already have her in for questioning, same as me." If Mac noticed Miki Kaworu's fist tightening around his stopwatch at that, he didn't make note of it as he continued, "Jacron, Sky, you two may not even be questioned." He shuddered, gripped the chair a bit, and added, "I'll have that water now, please, Miki." A glass of water later, he continued, "They only put me through a first-level probe, pro forma. They wanted me because I'm the first free spacers they've been able to cast their net over. I can expect a more serious probe in the next 2 to 3 days, and so can Moose and Miki. You're already on their lists as associates of the fugitive blip, and Mickey's a duelist, so they want him anyway." Mac pushed himself slowly to his feet, his stance now steady, his motions fluid, as he said, "I don't know about you, but I intend to get out of here." With that, he stepped into his bedroom, and when he failed to come back out again, the others began to talk.
"How dare they abuse my roommate like that,"
Jacron muttered, his heart not quite up to his usual bluster. As Alin Devir Natashkin sat off to the side, arms folded, eyes shuttered, silent, Miki glanced at her, concerned. She was normally so upbeat that it was shocking to see her usually indomitable spirit so subdued. She caught his glance and met his eyes briefly, then went back to what she was doing, which looked a good bit like brooding. Sky's tail-tip stood still against the back of the couch as he said, "Well, friends, I do not have the faith even good Harcourt has in the benevolent negligence of our captors. At the very least, the duelists will never be let free again." Nodding to Jacron, he added, "And even I have heard certain rumors of uncouth experiments supposedly conducted upon orphaned Narn children by the Psi-Corps. I do not know their truth, and I would as soon not have the opportunity to learning it firsthand."
"We could get out of the campus and into town through steam tunnels," Moose muttered. "They'll miss us fairly soon, though. No hope whatsoever of running very far."
We can't leave without making sure the others are safe, Skaya insisted.
Especially Devlin, Moose pointed out, and the group nodded agreement on this.
The door to 22S2 opened again, and Mac stepped out. He had changed his clothes, exchanging his WPI uniform for a uniform with some vague resemblance to the one Utena usually wore when her WPI one wasn't required. Instead of being short, trim, and flattering, though, it was broad and long, the double-breasted wraparound tunic extending to the knees, below which matching gray slacks ran in perfect press down to brilliantly shined black brogans. The cuffs were trimmed with a broad band of dark blue, nearly the width of Mac's hands. Mac was struggling with the belt, which had a short cutlass scabbarded on his left side and a large Blastech modified blaster holstered on the right.
"What in the name of all the great houses is that?" Skye gasped, looking Mac's new clothing over. "This is a fine time to decide you wish to be a duelist."
"That's a Confederate Freespacer dress uniform," said Mia quietly. Mac reached to the lapel stretching across his collarbone, straightened the X-shaped Corellian anchor which marked his officer trainee status, and nodded. "Durandal, bless his knotted cybernet, is currently routing a low-priority email to my parents with a special code. In about an hour or so, I expect that mail to bounce from my parents to Home Fleet Command, then to Soup Fleet Chief of Intelligence, and possibly as high as Fleet Admiral Curtis herself." That tidbit gave him a slight smirk as he went on. "At which time my reserve commission as a shipowner's son will be activated, orders will be cut, and transportation provided. All that remains to be decided is where the rendezvous will be," Mac said with a weak grin, "and how we get there."
"And how we're going to get the others the hell out of there," said Wakaba Shinohara, her arms folded. "I'm not leaving without Utena."
"Going back into that gauntlet is crazy," said Moose. "They'd bag you for sure."
"Maybe, maybe not. I know a few tricks." Briskly, she surveyed the group, then said, "Mac, contact your people and find out when and where they can pick up the bulk of the group. I'm going to think about the rescue."
A number of blinks and incredulous looks met Wakaba's sudden, decisive statement. She looked back at them, one by one, and said,
"What?"
"Taking charge, Shinohara?" asked Juri Arisugawa with a bemused little smile.
"Somebody has to," Wakaba replied. Then she smiled, making a joke out of it, and added, "Anyway, I am the president of the Otori Academy Student Council in Exile. Somebody want to get me some tea?"
Juri shook her head with that same Vulcan smile, then went into the kitchen to make her president some tea.